It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if you're one of the many Wisconsinites who roll that recycling bin out to the curb, you may be interested in learning about what you might be doing wrong. We'll talk to a Wisconsin expert about how to be a more informed recycler. First, U.S. intelligence agencies say that satellite images show North Korea is expanding a weapons factory and building new intercontinental ballistic missiles. That's according to reports in the Washington Post. This comes just over a month after President Trump declared North Korea was no longer a nuclear threat after meeting with leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore. That meeting led to an agreement to continue negotiations with the goal of denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula in return for security guarantees from the United States. The new satellite images haven't been the only bump in the road. Earlier this month, North Korea called talks with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo regrettable. Jean Lee is the director of the Center for Korean History and Public Policy at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. She also opened the first Associated Press Bureau in Pyongyang, the North Korean capital, in 2012. Jean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to join you.
Well, this is all coming via this report in the Washington Post, a lot of this information. Can you tell us what we know about this site in question and the types of weapons that might be manufactured there?
The report published yesterday by the Washington Post is based on interviews that the Post reporters did with U.S. officials, so unnamed officials, who were analyzing satellite imagery. And this is a really crucial piece of information for us. You know, we don't have much access on the ground in North Korea, so we do tend to look at North Korea from above, from the skies. And satellite imagery is very useful for us in telling us what they're doing on the ground. And what they're reporting, based on what intelligence is finding, is that the activities, there's a lot of activity at this particular set of buildings just outside Pyongyang where we believe the North Koreans have been building or had in the past built ICBMs. These are intercontinental ballistic missiles that are designed specifically to strike the United States.
And more broadly, what do we know about North Korean activity when it comes to building and developing long-range missiles and their nuclear program in this month or so since talks with President Trump and Kim Jong-un?
Now, it should not come as a complete surprise because, honestly, the North Koreans, the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, said that he would halt testing, but I don't see anywhere that he said he would stop building or that he would not maintain the missile technology. And so we shouldn't be completely surprised that this activity has continued. I do believe that the North Koreans will continue to keep that program up throughout this process. Remember that the leader of North Korea agreed to work toward the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. At no point did he say, I'm going to give my weapons up completely, unilaterally. So this is part of a long process. And during that process, I think we'll likely see them keeping their program up to date. Now, just to give you a little bit of context, every type of activity, whether it's their missiles or their nuclear weapons, this is all banned activity. This is all banned by the UN Security Council, so it's in violation of international agreements. This predates all of these negotiations with the United States. They have, however, been testing nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles for years now, and that activity ramped up under Kim Jong-un, who has been very keen to be able to call his country a nuclear power. They have now gotten to the point, at this particular facility that we're talking about, they've built at least two of these ICBMs, and we had two launches late last year that were frightening, to be honest. These were test launches, and they did launch them straight up rather than across, just to show that they could launch them and that they, if they were sent in the direction of the United States, they could conceivably reach the mainland United States, so reach us here. And they did prove that. And after that, Kim Jong-un did say, okay, well, now I've proven that I've done that. We don't need to test them any further. But he has not said we're going to stop building them.
That said, as you say, it's no surprise that this kind of activity would continue. Do you view the negotiations between President Trump and Kim Jong-un as a starting point, as a positive thing that is moving our relations in a better direction between North Korea and the U.S.?
I am a bit critical of the way this happened in the sense that having a summit with the United States president, arguably the leader of the most powerful country in the world, gives the leader of North Korea a huge amount of legitimacy. And he himself has not given up that much in return. So normally with diplomacy, you would say that that is the end point. That is a reward that you give a country or the leader of a country that is a pariah nation like North Korea at the end of a process. But here we are. We have a president in the White House who does things very differently. We're at this point now where he has chosen to do this differently, and so we have to look at it as a starting point. There's a lot of criticism that President Trump has said, look, I've taken care of the nuclear threat. No, that's not true. I think that the nuclear threat has not been completely resolved, but we are now in the start of a process, and it will take a long time, but it's better to be talking to the North Koreans than to have the provocations. Any further testing, if they decide to go back to testing their nuclear weapons or their ballistic missiles, are going to be incredibly dangerous at this point. And so that is what we do not want. And I speak from the perspective of somebody whose parents live in South Korea. Most of my family is there. And I certainly don't want either the South Koreans or the North Koreans to be living with this shadow of war. And so if we can get to a point with the North Koreans where we're on a process, whether it's a peace process or a process toward denuclearization, that is a much better dialogue to be having than the fire and fury that we were having last year.
Talking to Jean Lee with the Center for Korean History and Public Policy at the Wilson Center about the latest between the U.S. and North Korea. Jean, denuclearization is a word that's thrown out a lot. Is it possible that we have two different meanings? The U.S. Thinks that means North Korea has no nuclear capability. North Korea thinks it means, yeah, we're not doing any more testing. We're not developing beyond what we already have.
There are different understandings of what this means, and this is one of my main concerns. To be honest, the North Koreans have been very consistent when they talk about denuclearization. When they talk about denuclearization, Kim Jong-un is saying, listen, I'm with you. I agree we shouldn't have nuclear weapons. I would love to see a nuclear weapons-free world. But you give up yours, and then I'll give up mine. And the United States is a verified nuclear power. The United States had nuclear weapons before the creation of the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and so does not have to sign on to it. And so North Korea is saying, hey, just like you, we have nuclear weapons. You give yours up and we'll give up ours. And so I think that, and from Washington, the understanding may have been, no, we're talking about you giving up your weapons and not expecting to give up anything in return in terms of their nuclear program or our nuclear program. And so there is a gap in understanding of what the definition is, and this is going to be a major problem in these negotiations going forward.
Now, we're looking at this from the United States. I understand you recently traveled to Seoul in South Korea to talk to people there, find out the attitude toward these talks and toward relations between South and North Korea. What are you seeing there?
It's so fascinating. You know, over the course of my career as a journalist, I've really seen South Korea just go on this emotional roller coaster over the years. They just recently came out of a 10-year period that was very hardline in terms of its North Korea policy because it was run by a series of conservative presidents. But we now have a very progressive-minded president in the Blue House, President Moon Jae-in, who has always campaigned on a policy of engaging the North Koreans. He is the son of refugees from North Korea who came down during the war. So he has family in North Korea. So he's a very different vision of how he wants his country and North Korea to coexist. I have to say that although South Koreans are extremely skeptical because they have been here before, they have gone through the whole process of being hopeful and then having their hopes dashed by North Korean provocations, still, they would much rather have peace than war. They are the ones who live there. They know that their future is intricately intertwined with what happens with North Korea. And so they are trying to ride this wave of reconciliation. And so that gap as well, between this gap of the optimism in South Korea and the pessimism and skepticism that we have here in Washington, concerns me because I think that any time there is a gap in the understanding between Seoul and Washington of what our goals are, what we would call a gap or any kind of distance in that alliance, that traditional South Korean-U.S. alliance, That is something the North Koreans will take advantage of. And so that is something that we analysts are looking at very carefully and trying to make sure that the governments in Seoul and Washington are in communication and are coordinated.
I've read that there are efforts in South Korea to have more commercial ties with North Korea. There's a sports diplomacy that's been going on, efforts to dial down tensions at the border.
Yeah.
Is there some kind of hope that increased contact between South and North Korea leads to changes in North Korean society and maybe North Korean government?
That's a strategy. And you only really have to look at Germany to see how that works. They called it a kind of trust politics. So trying to expose the East Germans to Western concepts and get them hooked on it. And that's a little bit of what I think the South Koreans want to do. They want to show the North Koreans, look at what we can offer you. And remember, like I said, it's been 10 years of a hardline policy and almost virtually no interaction between the South Koreans and the North Koreans. 10 years for my students, my university students in South Korea, is half their lives. So South Korea also needs to get their people used to the idea of a future that involves some engagement with the North Koreans. I do think that we should acknowledge that it really varies by generation how the South Koreans feel. Older South Koreans like my parents, who remember the country as one, feel very differently than, say, younger South Koreans who grew up in a democratic South Korea, have no interaction with the North Koreans and feel no connection with them. And so it really depends when you were born, how you feel about North Korea, and whether you see North Korea as part of your future. But what I tell them is, regardless of how you feel about the North Koreans will make sure that you have a role, and whether that means they provoke you or they work with you peacefully, they are going to make sure that you are working with them because they are completely reliant on South Korea as part of their future. And so it's not really a choice that the South Koreans have, and they're starting to realize that.
Jean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Jean Lee is the director of the Center for Korean History and Public Policy at the Wilson Center. She was with us to talk about where relations stand now with North Korea. Now, last week we talked with a national reporter about the export of recyclable goods and big changes that have happened. Now we focus on recycling here in Wisconsin. Our guest says it's important to keep in mind that rules and items accepted are different from place to place, and she's joining us today to talk about why it's important that we recycle right. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what you can or cannot recycle, a running household argument about where to put that one piece of garbage or recycling? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Melissa Johnson is president of Associated Recyclers of Wisconsin and director of Marathon County's Solid Waste Department. Melissa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be with you.
Well, Wisconsin recycling programs have gone through changes over the years, but give us a little of the history. How did we get started with recycling in Wisconsin?
Well, we've been recycling in Wisconsin for decades and decades and decades, just in informal ways. I think we can go back all the way to World War II. But more frequent or more recently, the recycling law that we now know was passed in the 1990s and late 1980s and early 1990s, and it really started as a landfill ban. The idea was is we wanted to preserve landfill airspace for those things that really needed to go to landfills, and we wanted to get those things that had value out of the waste stream, and we banned things like tin cans, aluminum cans, cardboard, newspapers, magazines, glass jars, etc. And that really was the foundation of what we still call today Wisconsin's recycling law.
And in most areas of the state, we've shifted from picking out paper goes here, metal goes there, glass goes there, and so on to what I think is called single stream recycling. Makes it easier for the person in the household. Does it make it harder for the recycling system?
Well, it certainly does, and it should be noted first that not every city in the state of Wisconsin, every municipality, uses single-stream recycling. We still are doing some of what you talked about, is putting the paper in one container and the tin cans in another. It's called source separated. We're still doing some of that in some parts of Wisconsin. So people should know that there are all types of collection of recyclables. But, yeah, you're right. Single-stream recycling was really designed to help us make it easy for people because, you know, we're all busy. You know, you're chasing after the kids after work or you're working late or, you know, you've got a family vacation. We want to make things simple. But in doing that, we kind of complicated the recycling stream. And when all of those jumbled things end up at a recycling center or material recovery facility, which we call a MRF, it can sometimes cause some complications.
And if we're getting it wrong, we might think, oh, no big deal. They can pick out my mistake at the other end. How much does that gum up the works?
Oh, it gums up the work to the point it actually shuts down the facility. And really? one of the biggest culprits is plastic bags or plastic film, because there are rotating drums and all kinds of things at these facilities. Now, I don't know if you've ever had a weed or a snowblower and got something caught in that auger. Well, imagine now having something 3 or 4 or 10 times larger than that with hundreds of plastic bags wrapped around it. By some estimates, I was told by one of our Aero members that the downtime and the cost to equipment and the cost of trying to clean up things like plastic bags wrapped around equipment cost this one facility an estimated about $250,000 a year.
Wow. Okay, yeah. So how the one issue is you go from one town or one county to another, and the rules may be different of what they'll take and how they want it. So check your local listings, I guess, is our rule?
Check your local listings. We've got a lot of great programs throughout Wisconsin, and even, for instance, in Marathon County here, we have a number of different municipalities, and each one has a separate program. And the recyclables collected at one city will go a different direction to a different material recovery facility than the neighboring municipality. They may use a different recycling center. So always check with your local provider and ask what can go in my recycling stream. If you're not certain, recyclemorewisconsin.org is a great place to start. We have a lot of resource information there about how to recycle right. Many of our Aero members have materials listed there, so a lot of different options on trying to figure out how to recycle right, Wisconsin.
Let's bring on a caller. Ron is with us in Norwalk. Ron, hi.
Yeah, hi, Rob. I'm a township supervisor in a township that has a landfill that serves several communities. And I just want to encourage people to recycle. In our township, it's usually 2-to-1, two bags of recycle to one of garbage. And it really has extended the life of the current cell that we have. It saved years on it. And it's really good for all of us. It's helped a bunch.
Ron, thanks a lot. Ron talking about preserving the lifespan of the local landfill, making it last longer because of recycling.
Absolutely. It sounds like Ron and his neighbors are doing a great job recycling. We love to hear that. We love to preserve landfill airspace, again, for those things that really need to be put there. And when we recycle, people don't realize this, but think about it in Wisconsin. What's one of our biggest industries is paper making. And when we recycle, what we're doing is we're actually contributing to the supply chain of our friends and neighbors who work at paper mills. That is an incredible asset that we in Wisconsin can help with to make sure we save jobs and help keep costs down at our industry so that they can stay here and be a vital part of our economy. Big part of it is making sure that we keep that supply chain nice and clean, make sure we clean out the containers, we make sure that we're not throwing things that shouldn't be in the recycling, so that when we're sending those recyclable materials to a paper mill or a plastic extruder or a foundry, we're sending them the best that Wisconsin can send them.
Ron, thanks for the call. We'll go to Victor now in West Allis. Victor, hello.
Well, hi. Yeah, I feel guilty for what I do here. I like to shred all my important documents, and then I throw it into my recycle bin with the magazines and other stuff. Does that shredded paper clog everything up?
That's a
Shredded paper, Melissa.
That's a very good question. The best thing to do, and I absolutely agree with you, if you've got confidential material, shred it to make sure your identity isn't stolen. Take the shredded material and put it in a paper bag and staple the top of that paper bag and then put it into your recycling bin. Because what you do if you lay it in there loose, what happens is by the time it gets to the recycling center, you can have bits of paper flying all over the place. So again, just put that shredded material right into a plastic or a paper grocery bag, staple the top, put it in your recycling bin.
Victor, hope that helps. We heard from Sharon on Facebook who asked if batteries can be recycled. She's in Dane County. Melissa, depending on where you are, I guess, is the deal with batteries?
Well, and again, when you say batteries, it used to be, you know, we talked about batteries, it was car batteries. Well, now they're all shapes and sizes, made with many different things, rare earth metals, lithium, lead acid batteries. First, you have to find out what kind of battery you have, and then find out if you have some local options. Do not place them in the recycling bin. And you can check on Recycle More Wisconsin to get some advice on battery recycling, or you can check with your local recycling program, or check with retailers. They may have a program of taking back some batteries. Many do, some don't. The idea is if you're getting rid of a battery, you're going to buy a new one. But really, be very careful and do not put batteries in the recycling bin, in particular lithium batteries, so cell phone batteries and toy batteries. They are a fire hazard. Please, please, please keep them out of the recycling bin.
That's all the time we have, Melissa. Thank you so much for joining us and answering listeners' questions.
It is my absolute pleasure.
That's Melissa Johnson, President of Associated Recyclers of Wisconsin and Director of the Marathon County Solid Waste Department. If you have recycling questions, you can visit recyclemorewisconsin.org or call your local municipality. First, if you're going to college in the 1960s, just before the Vietnam War era, the most common grade you might have seen in people's report cards was a C. But over time, receiving an A started to be more and more common. In today's college world, we're seeing higher GPAs, lots of A's, and it's become an accepted norm for a lot of people, maybe half a class, to graduate with some kind of special honors. Stuart Reustacher is a writer, scholar, and former professor of geophysics at Duke University. He's done extensive research on grade inflation. You can see the results on his website, gradeinflation.com. By the way, Stuart is originally from Milwaukee and a graduate of UW-Madison. Stuart, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob, and thanks, Seth, for having me on.
Well, you have charts on your website showing this dramatic change from the 1960s through the 70s and to today. What kind of trends have we seen since a C was the most common grade?
Yeah, as you noted, before the Vietnam War, C was the most common grade. And then in the Vietnam era, probably because professors were concerned that if they failed students, or male students in particular, they'd end up fighting in rice paddies in Vietnam, they started to raise grades, and B became the most common grade in the Vietnam era. And after the end of the Vietnam era, grades dropped down a bit nationally on average from the mid-70s until the mid-80s. And then from the mid-80s until the present day, there's been a gradual rise in the prevalence of the A. Now A is about, on national average, about 45% of all grades given are A's and A minuses at four-year colleges and universities. And A became the most popular grade and most common grade at four-year colleges and universities in the mid-1990s. And that trend continues to this present day.
And you kind of chalk up two eras, the Vietnam War era you mentioned. You say the era of, I think it's the student as consumer, is part of what's driving this. What does that mean? How does that play out?
Well, you had a change in the attitude of administrators towards students in the 1980s, where students were no longer acolytes in search of knowledge, but were customers. And that trend in attitude became stronger and stronger in the mid-80s and the 1990s. It became commonplace for students to evaluate professors. Professors believed that if they graded higher, they would get higher evaluations, which would help them come tenure time if there was tenure, or if they did not have tenure, during reappointment if they received high student evaluations. So when the student is a customer and no longer an acolyte, the customer is always right. And during that same time, tuition started to outpace earnings for your average family, and that trend continues to this day. And as tuition rose, parents and students started to think that they weren't just students, but they were also buying something with their high tuition. They expected to see a higher grade come graduation time.
And when you were a professor, did you feel pressure from above the administration or below the students to not give out a C, even though that might have been the right grade to give?
I stopped giving Cs entirely. Let's see, I started teaching in 1998. I retired in 2015. I stopped giving Cs entirely in about 1998. It just became too objectionable to students to give that kind of grade at Duke University, where about half the student body graduates with today with about a 3.65 GPA or better.
Talking about grade inflation with Stuart Roystacher. He's been studying this since he was a professor at Duke University and beyond. Stuart, is this something that damages the educational experience for students? Does that student coming out of college learn less if there's not that pressure, that worry that they're going to get a C or below?
Well, there are indications and data that tell us that students are studying less than they once did. A student at a typical four-year college or university is studying about 10 to 12 hours a week nowadays. And part of that reason is because they know by putting in the minimum effort, they will get a B or better. So they are likely learning less than ever before after the end of their 4 years.
You also write on your website that in that Vietnam War era, there was an attitude among some professors that, hey, maybe grades aren't the best way to measure student performance anyway, so what if I give them a B instead of a C or an A instead of a B? Are grades a good way to measure student achievement at the college level?
Well, there's been a tremendous amount of research on that topic. We don't have an alternative. We could have extensive write-ups at the end of the semester where a professor or an instructor gives a long, page-long description of how well they thought that student did. That's probably not practical except at a few small colleges. That's probably a better alternative, but it's just not practical. So in lieu of that, we established about 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago, this four-point or five-point, depending on where you were, grading system where A meant excellence. And it seemed to, not seem to, it was a good indicator for employers of whether a student was a good student or a bad student. And it seemed to provide for a significant, not all, but for a significant share of the student body motivation to work hard. So it was a system that worked well. Does it work well now? It's starting to fall apart right now, to be honest.
You were quoted recently in a Wall Street Journal piece that looked at these Latin honors, forgive my Latin mispronunciations, the cum laude and magna cum laude recognitions for students, finding there were once that was a sign that, hey, this is one of our best students. Now it's, a third to a half of our students are getting these kind of honors. Does that dilute the meaning of those honors?
Yes, it does. So when you have half the student body graduating with honors, it creates a problem for employers when they try to identify outstanding students. That student with honors may be just a run-of-the-mill student at that university, and that student could well have a 3.7 GPA. So on paper, they look great. When the student comes to work for an employer, they find out that this particular student wasn't particularly well motivated, doesn't know a whole lot, doesn't have the skill set required for the job. So there is a disconnect between how we grade today and what employers and graduate schools and professional schools need in terms of evaluation for being able to identify the best and the brightest. And I don't like to focus on penalizing students by giving them low grades. I think the best tool of grades is to identify those who are exceptional. And when we start to lump the exceptional with the mediocre, it becomes very difficult to see who really, based upon some sort of method, in this case a four-point grading system, who really is the outstanding student. And it penalizes the outstanding student because they don't get the recognition, the special recognition they deserve.
We're talking to Stuart Roystacher, writer, scholar, former professor at Duke University. He's done extensive research on grade inflation. Joining us to talk about high honors, magna cum laude and others becoming the norm at universities, A's becoming the most common grade at colleges around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a student or past student who's felt like good grades and awards were given out too freely? Did you graduate with these kind of high honors? Did it feel special? Do you see, whether as a student, a teacher, anybody on a college campus, or looking at it from the outside, this kind of grade inflation? If you're at the high school level working in schools, do you feel pressure there to inflate grades? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Stuart Roystacher, former professor of geophysics at Duke University, talking about grade inflation at colleges and how graduating with honors has become the new norm for many schools. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed this as a student, as an instructor, somebody on the campus? Have you seen it at the high school level? And in general, do you think it's bad if everybody's getting A's? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Stuart, to recognize those very high achievers you're worried about, do we need to create a new currency of grade inflation, a super A or A with something else, something that goes above and beyond the A?
Well, there are schools that have A pluses, and that has given a new category of grade, so it's possible to graduate with a 4.3 GPA. And high schools already do this, right? They have numerous bonuses off the 4-point system where people can graduate with a 4.8 GPA. And it's possible that by creating a super grade and admitting that A is just for a good student, which is really what we've done now, we will have created, at least for a few more decades, a workable system. You know, in a way, grades are currency, and there's a natural tendency for any currency to inflate over time. And your suggestion is something that has been brought up by others, and I'm fairly positive about that idea. But it seems almost impossible to be able to knock down grades again. So we might as well create a super grade that is a new grade for excellence.
Let's go to our callers now. Kyler is on the line in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that teachers, I think they've been giving out higher grades because a lot of the students need those high grades to achieve what they need to. I'm an engineering student at Madison, and I know that if an employer is going to hire me, I have to have high grades. And a lot of teachers give them out because they're sympathetic to that.
All right. Thanks for the call, Stuart. Is that something you've seen?
Certainly. And there have been discussions at faculty meetings, academic councils at various colleges and universities that raise this very point, that where a university or college is aware that their grades are relatively low compared to their peers. And at these academic council meetings, faculty discuss that they probably should raise grades across the curriculum and in order to give their students a competitive advantage because employers and graduate schools tend to look at that grade point as an indicator of whether a student is employable or admittable into their graduate and professional program.
Let's go back to our callers. Polly is with us in Crown Point. Polly, hello.
Hi. I'm a high school teacher. I'm in Indiana. I worked in Wisconsin for 15 years, which is one of the reasons why I'm still listening to this. But two things I wanted to say. Actually three things now. I agree with the previous caller in that, you know, it's the grades have become the all important thing. I honestly think learning isn't as important as the grade, you know. And I think we need to get away from that. I don't know how, because, you know, you try to get kids to want to learn something, and they're like, well, what do I need to get the A? And it's like, well, that shouldn't be the point. But the second thing I wanted to say was the second thing I wanted to say was I have seen so much more anxiety in our students. I teach high school, as I said, and I teach Spanish. So I teach a class that most students will take so that they can go to college. And I have seen so much more pressure on students in the last 10 years. I've been teaching for almost 25 years in the last 10 years than I had seen before. And I think part of that's because it's so expensive to go to college that they want to take all the AP classes and they want to get A's and all that so that they can get scholarships so that they can go to college.
Polly, I'm going to cut you off before point three because we just have a few minutes left. Stuart, Polly's seeing anxiety from her students, a fear of the consequences of not getting that high grade.
That's a common thing. It really is. And I would identify loosely two classes of students. Those who are just happy to get their B or better and slack off and aren't anxious. They're just happy to graduate with 3.3 or 3.4. And that group is big. And then there's a smaller group that understands that because of grade inflation, or another way of calling it grade inflation is called grade compression, everybody is bunched up at the top, and they want to distinguish themselves. They know that at some of these schools, to get an A-minus means that they won't get honors. You know, you get an A-minus, that puts you in 3.7 territory. You might not get honors at your college or university. And they are increasingly nervous about getting only A's, and their anxiety ridden. So it's interesting what grade inflation has done. It's created this class of students that is quite happy to just wake up, barely do the work, and graduate with a B-plus or better, and this other class of student that knows that somehow they must distinguish themselves when everyone's bunched up at the top, and they're nervous as anything.
Polly, thanks for the call. We'll go to Maggie in Madison just briefly. Maggie, hi.
Hi. I was just going to say I graduated from Princeton in 2005, and it was the first year of their school-wide grade deflation policy. And they actually attempted to do this and included a letter with all of our transcripts that went to graduate schools and employers explaining why our grades dropped so significantly our senior year. And it was my understanding they thought that other Ivy League schools in particular would follow suit, and I don't think anybody did. So
wow. Maggie, thanks a lot. Pushing back against the tide there, Stuart, is there any hope in our last few moments that somebody could actually deflate grades again?
Well, Princeton tried, and I think they were actually quite successful, but they received so many complaints from students, parents, and alumni that they finally ran up the white flag and went back to their old inflated ways. There are schools, Wellesley and Reed, that have maintained relatively low grades, but realistically, I don't think that can be done across the country at this point in time.
We'll leave it there for now. Stuart, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That was Stuart Reustacher, writer, scholar, and former professor of geophysics at Duke University. He's done extensive research on the topic of grade inflation. You can see more and a lot of charts to show how grades have changed over the years at his website, gradeinflation.com. Many school districts across Wisconsin are seeing their enrollment decline. In Milwaukee, the drop is due in part to fewer school-aged children, but the growing popularity of the state's voucher program that helps some families pay for private schools has also played a role. As Jimena Condi reports, Milwaukee Public Schools is trying a new recruitment tactic this summer, but whether it can market its schools better remains to be seen.
A high school drumline plays for a crowd of more than 100 people in front of MPS headquarters. On this June morning, Keith Posley, acting head of the district, is launching a first-of-its-kind student enrollment campaign.
Go to doors and explain to family members the love and all of the great things that are happening in the Milwaukee Public Schools.
A couple of hours later, Tom Bruno, principal of U.S. Grant Elementary, is trying to do just that in the school's surrounding neighborhood.
Good morning. How are you?
Bruno and five other canvassers are going door-to-door, ready to extol the virtues of public schools like Grant. Bruno can rattle off the ways students there get a well-rounded education.
Last year, we started musical theater with our middle school group. They did Hamilton, Hairspray, and High School Musical together. They did these medleys. The parents just loved it. You know, we offer art, we offer PE.
But U.S. Grant is not the only school vying for students.
Two blocks away, we have St. Raphael's, and they have two school buildings. We have the new St. Augustine. We have St. Anthony's.
This year, MPS reported enrollment at less than 78,000 students. That's down from 97,000 in 2003. That's meant fewer state dollars for a district strapped for funds. Some funding that could have gone to MPS now follows 28,000 students that use vouchers to attend private schools. It's likely several of those students could be going to U.S. Grant. Bruno says he understands why parents would make that choice.
5 years ago, we were on the failing list.
Grant students were underperforming in reading and math compared to the state average. And while students at Grant are now performing better than the overall district, Bruno says some parents may not know. But at a block party at St. Anthony's, one of Bruno's competitors, families say they opted into the voucher program based on more than academic performance.
You can, you know, participate more without being afraid to ask questions or just like that motivation that the teacher provides for you.
That's Daniela Garcia. She made the switch to private school after the fourth grade. Now in high school, Daniela says she loved the smaller class sizes. Her mother, Albita, says she was sold on the culture.
Que a nosotros nos hacen parte.
They make us part of that mindset that university is possible for everyone. But I learned that with the education and the information they gave me at the school.
Annabelle Macias says the extracurricular activities offered influenced her choice, as did religion.
Because it's Catholic, and I'm 100% Catholic, and because they use uniforms too.
The Cleveland Metropolitan School District has been where MPS finds itself. The district's enrollment dropped to less than 35,000 students in 2011, an almost 50% loss from 2002. Rick McIntosh oversees enrollment for Cleveland Metropolitan. He says to stop the decline, his district has had to embrace the idea that parents have options.
We have to really understand that we are changing the culture.
Cleveland tried a door-to-door enrollment effort, but it wasn't enough on its own. In 2012, the district launched a set of school reforms that included creating more magnet high schools and expanding pre-K for four-year-olds. Then the district launched a campaign to inform parents of the changes. McIntosh says it aims to get parents to look past the district's shortcomings.
So that makes families really consider us an option to come to or to stay within.
Since then, enrollment has increased by about 5%. MPS already does some types of community outreach like high school and career fairs and has seen enrollment increase by almost 2,000 students or almost 3% in 2 years. But whether the door-to-door enrollment campaign will build on that success remains to be seen. On the day of its launch, Bruno's group failed to enroll a single student. Jimena Condi, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Here's your clue. This TV game show host says he may retire at the end of his current contract after what would then be a 36-year run. Producer Dean Kinetter, do you have a question for that answer?
Who is Alex Trebek?
Yeah, I kind of gave it away by playing the theme song
a little
there.
Bit,
huh?
Yeah.
Now, Trebek says he may be ready to be done in 2020 after his current contract. He is suggesting people to replace him. He replaced original host Art Fleming. I came into the producer's office, and there was a gasp of dismay at the concept of a Trebekless Jeopardy.
I was disappointed. He's part and parcel with the show. I think it's a really tough job, and he does it really well. It's going to be big shoes to fill.
And 1984, I think I did the math right, is when he started doing this. So I can't remember if I watched it. You're not old enough to have seen Art Fleming. He was in the Weird Al video.
That's right.
Yeah. But you're a fan of Jeopardy, the show, the concept.
I like it a lot. I grew up watching it. Every afternoon after school, I'd come home and watch Ken Jennings or whoever else was winning tear it up, and Alex was always there.
And, you know, watching at home, I always feel like I would do well on the show, and I'm sure I would just panic and, like, just...
It's a great boost. When you get one or two right, you feel good for the rest of the day.
But I would be... Yeah, I think I would freak out and be really terrible. Thanks, yeah. Dean. We'll watch for the future of Jeopardy.